Hello and welcome to our second Gascast Gatcast, this year in Oxford, the City of Dreaming Spires. It's a pleasure to once again be talking to President of the AAGBI, William Harrop Griffiths, and AAGBI Education Chair, Sam Shindy. Will and Sam, thank you very much for inviting us back and welcome to Gatcast number two.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So Glasgow last year was a fantastic conference, but what can we look forward to this year in Oxford?
Well, Sam, you're the one who created the programme. Take us through the highlights.
Well, the highlights for me actually are the Friday. We've changed Friday. Last year we had two parallel sessions with workshops and lectures for the exams. And this year we've split it into three streams. So we've got topics for the primary exam, the final exam, and a management section, which we thought we'd try this year. And judging by the numbers of people that have signed up, it seems to be the most popular session. So I'm really, really looking forward to Friday, a bit of something for trainees of all levels.
It's brilliant. It looks very complex from the matrix that you've kind of got there, but I've got to say it looks really exciting. I certainly am signed up for the management sessions. They look great. And for you, Will, what are you particularly looking forward to?
Well, I've just thoroughly enjoyed the Pinkerton lecture given by Danny Bryden. And Danny, as you probably know, was the semi-finalist in last year's Great British Bake Off, and I was kind of thinking that we might have something on baking, but it was nothing to do with that at all. Absolutely brilliant and inspirational, thought-provoking talk about competition. And, well, I won't go into it because you should have been there. You should have been listening to it. And actually, we've recorded it. So if you do want to listen to it, you can go to our website, www.aagbi.org, and enjoy the whole lecture. But I'll stop doing the advertisements. It was a fantastic lecture, and I really, really enjoyed that. And I'm looking forward to the rest of the meeting. And don't forget, we do GAT ASMs every single year. And Sam, when and where is next year's GAT ASM 2014?
2014, GAT is coming to Newcastle from the 11th to the 13th of June.
So let's see you all in Newcastle next year.
That was shamefaced. I mean, was that all right?
Yeah, I can't guarantee it will make it.
And here's Will and Sam. Hi, cut.
Hello and welcome to the Gascast Gatcast Gatasm Special, which for those of you not in the UK means we're back at the AAGBI's Group of Anaesthetists in Training annual scientific meeting. I'm Rick Thomas, and also taking time off from pushing propofol and slam dunking LMAs are Mark Salmon.
Hello.
Old rogues June Rahman and Sid Zanwar.
Hello.
And new voices Chaya Sharma and Priya Gill.
Hi.
As usual, if you want to see what Priya and Chaya look like and what makes them tick, then go to the website where their pictures and profiles are up.
So, they consent to that.
They are going to consent to that.
Our resident ethicist.
But so, thank you very much, guys. I'm sure you'll all agree it's been a fantastic meeting with absolutely loads going on both the academic and the social front, as evidenced by some of the slightly jaded faces in the lecture theatre this morning and actually sat around this table now. There's been way too much happening for everyone to go to everything, so I'm excited to hear what you've all been up to. But let's start by going around the table for some quick-fire discoveries of the conference. Priya.
Okay, so my discovery, which I'm not sure how many people already know this, is it was a really good case report that was done by, I think, an FY2, so that's even more embarrassing, that you can use intralipid for carbamazepine overdose, which you quite beautifully described that.
I've never heard of a case of a carbamazepine. What was the... Was it accidental or deliberate?
No, it was a deliberate overdose. So they'd had an argument and he'd taken his old shed load of drugs. She went through it brilliantly, actually, really well explained, because they talk about why activated charcoal would be good, because it's for mental absorption and hepatic metabolism, and why the intralipid would be good, because it's lipid-soluble. So like any other lipid-soluble drug, it would be a useful thing to go. So it's really opened up how else intralipid might be used in the future.
June, I'm sure you're going to disappoint.
Well, my discovery of the conference is that there were many really good quotes, which I'm sure will come out in the process.
It was starting already.
But I shall set the ball rolling with one from Louis Pasteur: chance favours only the mind that is prepared.
So it's basically another way of saying you make your own luck.
Exactly.
So moving around, Sibs, what's a standout bit of information for you?
My discovery of the conference happened in the dying moment when I realised that a senior consultant anaesthetist can earn more money than the Prime Minister, an Old Bailey judge, and even a British Army general. but it just gives some idea whether you think consultants have been paid too much or the other people have been paid not enough.
And I'm sure we're going to talk about that as well later, but I thought what was really interesting was not just that single fact, but the point he made, that there are so many consultants, hospital consultants in the UK, compared to prime ministers, obviously, but generals, Old Bailey judges. So it really gives you some idea of the significant outgoing.
It certainly puts it in perspective,
yeah. So, Mark?
So what I discovered was a lot of simple rules to help me when reading ECGs, and I really like simple rules. There's far too many to go through here, but I recommend you look up the talk by Nick Sabawar from Oxford on the GAP website. But the ones I'll tell you now are 80% of all broad complex tachycardias are VT, and that goes up to 95% if there's any history of ischemic heart disease or left ventricular systolic dysfunction. So if you're looking at broad complex tachycardia, play the odds, it's almost certainly going to be VT. And another humorous catchphrase to add to the collection is, digoxin is a weak drug for weak patients given by weak doctors.
Western was on the ABC of arrhythmias, which is I'm your drug, bleep cardiologist. I guess some people use digoxin.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark. And actually, you just reminded me to remind everybody else that lots of the lectures, probably I think most of them, are available on the AAGBI website. They should be up by the time this podcast released. So if we're talking about a lecture and it sounds like something that you might be interested in, you can go to the AAGBI website, look it up, and listen to the lecture for yourself, which is a really great service. Finally, Chaya, what have you got for us?
Okay, there's a slightly small print. There's lots of great stuff, but one of the things that kind of stuck out is I was looking around the posters, and there was one on a case presentation of a pheochromocytoma. Pheochromocytoma.
It is a difficult word. It is a difficult word.
A pheo that presented in theatre. And apart from lots of other medication, they administered magnesium. And a few days later, the patient went back and had a litre of blood removed from their abdomen. And they were sort of wondering whether the administration of magnesium-induced platelet dysfunction contributed to that. To be fair, I'm not particularly, I wasn't aware of platelet dysfunction association with magnesium because I sort of thought of it as one of these things that you can give to almost anyone for almost anything. It's generally a good thing as long as you don't dose them up to the eyeballs and it's okay. But the references they had were from a good sort of 15, 20 years ago. So I don't know, but worth looking into maybe.
Oh, that brings us around to me for my discovery, which, like Sibs, was in the dying moment. So there was a very good talk by Andrew Hartle on the subject of consent, which I know June enjoyed, yes. But what I didn't realise is there are a few defences you can use for assault. One of them is lawful sporting activity, so boxing or playing rugby and that sort of thing. And one of them is medical and dental treatment carried out by qualified practitioners. He said one of them that is not is engaging in sadomasochistic behaviour. And he said if you want to know more about it, then look up Operation Spanner in the 1980s, which of course I did, which is all about when the police found some tapes of 60 men engaging in S&M activity, and they were so disturbed by what they saw, they actually opened a murder inquiry straight away. And then having gone down the route of a very expensive murder inquiry and discovered many of the men, well, all of the men, in fact, were not only still alive and well and recovered from their injuries, but were consenting to it, actually went ahead and prosecuted them anyway. And it's become a test case, which was turned down by a Judge Rant, who decided that the activities in which they engaged fell outside the exceptions to the law of assault, in which we actually normally practice medicine, not S&M.
I mean, that links in nicely with consent in research, because even though a patient can volunteer themselves and say, do what you like with me, we are still duty-bound to make sure that they are safe and protected.
Very good. And actually, will that segue us nicely into your interview, June, with Andrew Hartle, when you caught up with him to talk about some consent and ethical issues?
That's right, in anaesthesia particularly.
I'm here at the Oxford GET ACM talking to Dr. Andrew Hartle, who is the immediate past honorary secretary of the AAGBI. He's also a consultant intensivist and anaesthetist at St Mary's in London, amongst his many other interests and clinical roles. He has been chairman of the Clinical Ethics Committee and is now trust lead for consent and mental capacity. So, written consent in anaesthesia. The question of whether we should be obtaining written consent for anaesthesia from patients has been an ongoing debate. One of the arguments in favour of written consent being that it provides some legal and ethical protection to the patient, and it also ensures that the anaesthetist has disclosed to the patient adequate, pertinent information as per the GMC guidelines. The difficulty is knowing how much information to give to a patient. In reality, you often see them just before they're about to have their operation. And if you didn't give them all the potential life-threatening or permanently disabling risks that may happen to them, then there is a chance that they may then refuse the operation.
I think you can almost take it back a step. There's quite a strong argument that patients don't really consent to anaesthesia in the first place. But one of the requirements for consent to be valid is that consent must be entirely voluntary. There must be no coercion. Now, I don't know what happens in your hospital, but I get virtually no referrals saying, "Dear Dr. Hartle, please see this patient and anaesthetise them." Patients are only having an anaesthetic to have something else done that they either want to have or need to have. So the true voluntary nature of consent to anaesthesia is highly questionable. I think the worry about the emphasis on written consent is, again, it places the emphasis on consent with a piece of paper, whereas the key bit about consent is that it's a process. There has to be the opportunity for the patient to get the information that that patient needs. It's not generic. It's what information is important to that patient about the anaesthetic options and choices available to them. I agree entirely that a move to lean, efficient use of theatres actually makes this much, much more of a challenge for us. Most of my patients are day cases that I've been meeting in a 30-minute period immediately before the start of the list. I'm going to be one of three or four people that are seeing them, pre-op nurses, surgeons. And if that's the first opportunity they've had to get any real information about anaesthesia, that's really too late. But the challenge for us is, how do you get that information out to patients beforehand? Yes, you can give leaflets, you may use pre-anaesthetic clinics, you can use web-based resources, but almost the patients who most need the information are the people least likely to access those resources.
Right. So offering them a piece of paper in order to sign, to demonstrate that they have understood and taken in the information and weighed up the options and been given the options, because we don't often give them options, is another way of proving that they have.
I think there are all sorts of things you can do, as well as written instructions and web-based things. I think you can rely very heavily on my usual customary practice. So my standard pre-op chat to patients, there are core bits that I say to each and every patient about airway management, teeth, sore throat, pain relief. And I will say the same thing to each and every one. And I have a standard shorthand way of reporting. So I've written rather than ticked somebody else's boxes. If you went to 10 consecutive patients of mine, they would all say I'd said that. If there's specific advice I've given to that patient that's different to another one, I'll make a specific note of that. And I think the other key thing is they've got to have had the chance to ask questions, and you've got to make a note of what that question was and the advice you gave. But that all of a sudden makes that very quick 5 or 10 minute consultation in the day consulting really difficult. And does my hospital want me to spend 15 minutes with each of 5 patients? No, they don't. That's not efficient. Do I think that's the right thing to do? Yes. Do the patients like it? Yes, but there's this constant challenge between efficiency and doing what you think is best for the patient. I think it's one of the real tests of our communication skills. And at the same time, as you quite rightly say, you've got to give them appropriate information, but not scare the willies out of them.
That's right.
And actually, I've now incorporated that. So I actually say to them, I'm now going to tell you everything that can go wrong, but also tell you, this is one of the safest things that will ever happen to you.
Oh, that's a good way of putting it, because it's often been argued it's not in the patient's best interest to put them into such distress, such that they don't want to come into hospital anymore.
I think for most patients it's actually worth saying that the most dangerous thing they'll do on the day of surgery is travel to the hospital.
Yes, that's right. Last question, if we have time. As a clinical lead in ethics and consent capacity, in the States, they often have an in-house ethicist, particularly in intensive care units. Do you think there may be a role in the UK for full-time ethicists in the hospital or in the intensive care unit?
Not always. I think that in an intensive care unit where there's a reasonable understanding of clinical ethics and the challenges, where you've got an effectively working multidisciplinary team, the need for some external resource is less necessary. I think the places that have the problem is people that just don't recognise there's an ethical dimension to the intensive care conundrum. You want to remember that the ethicists that come in the States often come from a religious background. An awful lot of ethics interns are actually ordained priests who bring with them a slightly different view. I think an ethicist without a clinical background is a bit of a theoretician, and actually what you want is a clinician with a good understanding of the ethical challenges that face you.
Harvey, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
So thanks for that, June. That was a great interview, bar the hoovering, which we failed to remove. So that moves on to the main part of how we're going to do this podcast. So we're going to change format slightly from what we usually do. We've all picked a lecture, all six of us, where we're going to give you the title and the speaker, a very brief summary of the contents of the lecture, and then the learning points that we took home, and then have a little discussion about it between ourselves, see if we agree, disagree. So why don't we start with you, Sibs, and you're going to tell us about the NIAA lecture.
I am, yeah. So Dr. Ramli Munasinghe, who's a council member of the NIAA, gave a talk on, mainly as an introduction to research for trainees, but on the NIAA, what it does and how we can engage with it. So she started off by making the point that anaesthesia research and its profile within the UK and internationally is improving. It's not in decline as it may well have been a decade ago. She essentially spent the first half of her talk going through some of the incentives for the individual, how it does add value to careers, how it avoids everyone simply becoming an anaesthetist who pushes propofol and slam dunks LMAs. It gives an opportunity to shine and separate yourself from your colleagues if that is something that's important to you in the future. So her talk went on to concentrate largely on health services research, emphasising the work that's been done by full-time anaesthetists throughout the UK, namely the NAP audits, but also other national audits, such as the Emergency Laparotomy Network, as well as systematic review work throughout the country. And then she sort of finished off by talking about quality improvement work carried out by themselves, but also other centres throughout the UK. She made the point that this sort of work often leads to a reverse translation, bed to bench, so it allows new ideas to come up which can then be tested with more with clinical trial-orientated research or indeed basic science research. She made the point that this is something that everyone can engage with and specifically talked about courses. They're running a two-day introductory taster course in September and a week in October. So we can talk about, as I'm sure we will, whether research is for everyone, whether everyone does need to engage with research, whether it is simply a box-ticking exercise.
Before we discuss any of that, I think probably the most important thing is that we say that is a lecture on the video website that you have got to see. She did this amazing slide with just a bottle of propofol and an LMA, and her point was that you spent 20 years in education, probably 10 years in postgraduate education, and essentially if you're just going to turn into one of these people who pushes propofol and slam dunks LMAs, then you're probably not making the best of the incredible investment that people have put in you. And in fact, research is something that was for everyone. But it was just spot on. She's an absolute rock star. Right?
And not just you're not making the most of your education and training, but also there's a possibility that you may talk yourself out of a job in the future.
Can we just roll straight into the one I want to talk about and then take the discussion from there? Because the one that really inspired me was also quality improvement. I was expecting to enjoy Ramani's lecture, whereas I was not expecting to enjoy driving value in anaesthesia from quality improvement to new systems working, by Jonathan Fielden, who's the medical director of UCH. He immediately got me with his first slide, which was a very simple equation, and we all love simple equations. He asked us all what we thought value was, and lots of people said things like money. But he said value is health outcomes over the cost of delivering those outcomes, and then made the point that quality improvement in services, which is what Ramani was talking about, can in fact drive down healthcare costs. And this is an enormously powerful idea, especially in the times cutbacks in the NHS and working out as a medical profession how we can save money. And then he went on to talk about the challenges associated with designing these systems and delivering these outcomes. There's a culture of apathy that exists within healthcare, and that's partly to do with the nature of our work. But the working environment is completely predictable. We work with sick people, and the same mistakes are made time and time again. And it's the harm that comes to patients that we can really wind down, and we should be aiming for zero. Quality improvement in healthcare is a massive research opportunity, and it is different from audit. Audit is about finding a standard, comparing your practice, whereas quality improvement is about spotting something that's wrong with the system, working out what the outcome is you're interested in, how you're going to measure that outcome, and then designing a system to do that. And immediately, there's all these sort of things that you can think of that are going to make a real difference to patients. The other two things which I really liked about his talk, he suggested that, in fact, trainees are a really good resource to use for this type of thing. Consultants who come into a hospital within a few years will only know the system within which they work, whereas being a very sort of mobile population, which trainees are, moving from hospital to hospital to hospital, they will inevitably soak up different ideas and the working practices that they're exposed to. This gives them sort of a freedom of thought to be able to design ideas, to take little pieces, put things together, see what's going all over the place, identify problems that have just become part of the wallpaper in other hospitals. I think that recognition that he put there, I thought, was really forward thinking, because normally when you're a trainee and you come up with an idea to improve something at a hospital, people immediately, well, my boy, you've only been here 10 minutes.
But he also made a very good point that, you know, in terms of risk and doing our job with risk or doing it safely, we at the moment perhaps sit at the end where we're craftsmen or artisan, and in order to become safer, we probably have to become less independent and more dependent on systems or protocols and just give up this ideal that we can individually make a decision on each case entirely from the top of our heads.
There was a very interesting presentation given by one of the trainees actually about how she went about to make quality improvements, and by doing small things, starting off with, for example, taking a survey and asking patients what they wanted and how they could change and get them involved in care pathways. And it began with patients, when they wake up after an anaesthetic, they want to know what time it is, so they put clocks up, you know, and it's all about improving patient satisfaction as well as care, of course.
It sounds a bit woolly, but she's made up an outcome measure and then measured it. It's just great, and you can do that. And in fact, it is making a difference.
Most patients.
No, I think it does.
Most patients care more about the fact when they wake up 7 or 8 times in recovery, they know what time it is every time, than length of stay in hospital by an extra 4 hours.
And the scar they have.
The things that we measure are not necessarily the things that patients really care about.
Yeah. To be mercenary in terms of just CVs, I mean, this is all within the realm of the training, it's still clinical, to do this kind of research. So, you know, there's so much pressure now to kind of build our back page that actually this kind of research is useful for us and it's useful for the patients. And, you know.
Do you remember I interviewed Kenny Bailey from the last GATT?
Yeah.
So he's gone on to do, you know, amazing work in genetics, and we published in Nature and all sorts of fantastic things. But he cut his teeth. I don't know if you remember his lecture, what he cut his teeth on, which was swabbing anaesthetic machines and growing bits and pieces from them and publishing it in Anaesthesia, which is exactly what you're talking about. You know, there's pressure to do stuff. What are you going to do? That's not going to change anybody's life. But you can do really...
I'm not saying that. That's not the kind of nonsense research I was talking about, for the record. Because
that's not nonsense. That's what I'm saying.
Swabbing anaesthetic machines.
God, infection control is, you know.
It is nonsense research. Unless you prove a correlation between what's growing on an anaesthetic machine and something
to do
with
patients. It's got to be the link. You've got to fill every step along the way.
That's like measuring the number of cups of coffee brought into anaesthetic rooms and outcomes in the hospital.
Hmm.
Yeah. But let's get back to the point in question, which, bringing it back round to Ramani's talk and quality improvement, was one of the points that she made was the fact that a lot of the people who are doing really important, big quality improvement research are full-time clinicians with families and hobbies and other stuff, and they're publishing big studies in big journals that have a big impact. I mean, don't mean academic impact factor, I mean actually a big impact on patients.
On patients, on the anaesthetic community, on public press, on public engagement.
Yeah. And these are not people who have taken the route of going down and doing, you know, lots of bench work.
Bothering rats,
exactly. And it's possible to do it. It's accessible for trainees, consultants alike. So let's go from something that's been research-based, and we've been talking about quality improvement and clinical outcomes, to Priya and Shire talking to Dr. Mansuk Poppet about NAP4 outcomes and implementation of guidelines.
So we've caught up with Dr. Mansukh Popat today after a fascinating talk on tracheostomy management. Dr. Popat is an airway and obstetric specialist, the NAP4 guru, and ex-president of the Difficult Airway Society. Dr. Popat, thank you for taking the time to speak to us.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and I hope what I say will be useful to you and your audience.
Thank you. NAP4 was a huge success, but I wanted just to ask you a little bit about the NAP4 results, what surprised you, and how you can implement the recommendations that you made.
The two things that really surprised me most were the number of deaths due to regurgitation and aspiration. Mm-hmm. In my mind, I certainly was under the impression that we had basically solved that problem, because mm-hmm. that problem sort of surfaced in the 70s and 80s after rapid sequence induction and all that. Then we introduced H2 blockers, and I thought we'd become better at preventing, but it seems that we become too lax about it. Mm, so even in patients in whom you would expect a higher percentage of them having regurgitation, say for example trauma or obesity, it was found in the report that anesthetists were too lax about putting in practice even fairly standard preventative measures. So
yeah.
To me, that was a big surprise. The second surprise possibly was the number of claims, or number of patients who suffered from extubation and recovery problems. You know, so that formed like almost a third of the cases.
What would you, can you... Do you know what you would attribute that to? Do you think it's sort of people becoming a bit too au fait with the
aspirations? Yes, I think so if you go back, for example, to aspirations, as I mentioned, you know, in most cases, very basic preventative measures were missed. There was sort of, lack of strictness to say, well, okay, this patient's at risk, I'm going to do it. So, for example, a lot of the trauma patients were managed with a supraglottic device, knowing that they may have full stomachs, and they should have ideally been managed by rapid sequence induction.
And so to prevent regurgitation with that, essentially, that's the main thing, isn't it?
Yes. I think, you know, obese patients not getting, H2 blockers or proton pump inhibitors, and, you know, that extra bit of care that is required. And some of the cases happen at extubation, so people possibly are not aware of the fact that regurgitation and aspiration is an equally,
an equally risky time.
Risky time
and
at extubation.
And we're surprised that that's not a well understood thing, because that's
something we should be completely aware of. Yeah, I think the extubation one again wasn't quite surprising, but I think that's where a lot of the problems happen in extubation, purely because of lack of planning rather than any technical problems. Because if you look at extubation and recovery, they are not strictly technical procedures. You obviously need to carry this out properly, but it was lack of planning and not making sure that you had backup plans should extubation fail.
That's quite a common problem, isn't it?
Yes. So if you then drag it back, you ask yourselves, how much importance has extubation and recovery been given in your training compared to, intubation? You probably say, well, 10% maybe.
So
I think it was just a question of raising the awareness, the profile, and then, as it happened, luckily, the Difficult Airway Society had already initiated the extubation guidelines,
yeah.
which will hopefully...
So that's already used to address that.
Yeah, that has... Yeah. So the planning and implementation in way of guidelines has been addressed. So you can say some of the recommendations in the extubation chapter have already been fulfilled. In a sort of...
Just going back to the preventing regurgitation and aspiration, there's a gastric ultrasound. I think there's just been a little bit of unsurety maybe of people maybe being accused of overestimating the risk of rogue agitation, and how long do you leave it after a trauma case before actually
yes,
an empty stomach, yes. opioids versus trauma time versus all this kind of stuff. Do you see a role for gastric ultrasound?
Possibly. I think anything that enhances your awareness or leads you to believe that a patient may or may not be at risk is beneficial. And
is it a practice you've ever used or thought about using, or you think is useful?
I think after talking to you, I may use it.
So that was great, and actually marked some very interesting points about gastric ultrasound there for you.
I mean, as gastric ultrasound is a hobby horse, Mark, so I'm sure he's prepared to comment.
Having not heard the interview. But anyway, so...
I have to listen to last month.
Yeah, what was the gastric ultrasound? Well, because I never heard of it before that. I thought it was nonsense. I was like, what the hell does that mean?
Now, what do you think
but
now?
No, well, I've
where was
it
on the Sharma nonsense scale?
Well, no, because that was when I looked it up and I thought, oh, right, okay, fair enough. I've never done it and I'm not regular with ultrasounds, but I think it's a good idea. And Poppet thought it was a good idea.
You did the echo.
He did. Ex-president of DAST, seal of approval for gastric ultrasound.
Ex, you say?
Yeah.
Wonder.
So, June, I was sitting next to you during the Pinkerton lecture with Dr. Danny Bryden, and you were taking copious notes, so I'm sure you're going to be telling us about that.
Yes. It was a very inspiring lecture, I felt. An honest and passionate approach to the much talked about and hot topic of patient safety and improving outcomes, coming from a philosophical and ethical but with evidence angle of how to become a better doctor. It was entitled, Who Are Your Competitors? And the parts of it that stood out is that she said, everybody look around you and look at who is sitting next to you. Now, I've heard this before, and I was expecting her to say, they are your competitors. But what her message was, is that the only competitor you have is yourself. She covered areas about patient safety, alluding to error and how we can improve on error by changing the culture and the nature that we work in. And we can change the culture and nature we work in by changing our own characteristics. So if you look at what sort of characteristics makes a good doctor and you aspire to be that doctor, then we all are able to set our own standards and start. It's like looking at the man in the mirror. That's the way I saw it. But a lot of these non-technical skills are very soft, and a lot of people poo-poo them because we can't measure them. But they are now developing new methods of measuring non-technical skills. We see them in the simulation centre. It's all about getting to know people around you, having some humility, and having leadership skills, not by being bullshy and aggressive, but by bringing up the team with you, so supporting the team. If you work as a team player and within the team become the leader, you improve your working environment, and by improving your working environment and communication, you then reduce error.
Now, thanks for that, Jim. Actually, this is probably a good point to just move over to a little bit of you and me actually talking to Danny Bryden right after that lecture.
I'm here with Dr. Daniel Bryden, who delivered the inspiring Pinkerton lecture, asking, who is your competition? Dr. Bryden is an intensivist and an anaesthetist. She also has a master's in medical ethics and law, but perhaps more interestingly, recently competed in the Great British Bake Off. So, Dr. Bryden, what skills or lessons have you taken from the Great British Bake Off and applied in your job as an intensivist?
I think for me, the biggest thing I learned from it, which I do apply in life, and is the concept that there is no point competing against other people, even in obvious competitions, that the best thing to do is to always try and achieve the most that you are capable of or what you're happy with, and really not worry about what other people are doing. I learnt that even more in the Bake Off, in terms of competing against other people, but not competing against other people, being able to take pleasure in their success and helping them come along. And I think that's very relevant to what we do in anaesthesia and intensive care. We're working in teams and we want other people in the teams to perform as well as they're capable of. So I think there is quite a bit of parallel activity, really.
So it's about improving communication and being successful together rather than on your own?
Yeah, I think you will achieve more as a professional in the future by bringing other people with you, by always trying to be the best that you're capable of and helping other people who are in the teams that you're working in, rather than continually seeing success as being something that you drive for and achieve for yourself regardless of what other people do. It doesn't fit with what anaesthetists do as their career. We're team players, team leaders, that's what we are.
You talked a lot about success and measurement, which mm-hmm. is something obviously we have to do because mm-hmm. competition does exist.
Yeah.
So what I found interesting was your little bit about the way medical schools are now changing their interview mm-hmm. process. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not universal in medical schools, and there's still quite a bit of debate in the medical schools as to what is the best way of selecting. But there's certainly a vogue of some medical schools moving away from the things that can be coached, in terms of the interview skills, and looking more at those kind of personality traits or behaviours that can't be so easily taught by a school, but will actually be still a good marker of potentially a useful doctor.
And are we seeing this being translated into selection for postgraduate medical jobs or even consultant medical jobs?
I think, to be honest, it's always been translated into consultant medical jobs. We've just been talking about that. It's just that it's never been formally identified as that. But it's always been a situation that departments wanted to have people who fitted in well with department, who had particular skill sets or particular personalities and behaviours that fitted in with what the department was trying to achieve. And that wasn't entirely based on what that person could do in terms of a technical skill set. So I think it's always been there. It's just perhaps medical schools are formalising it now, and it hasn't quite got all the way through to postgraduate medical training, but I suspect it will come through into postgraduate medical training.
So one of the ways I perceive that this used to be measured was in the old reference system, where you used to get people to write you sort of a nice two-page handwritten reference about what you'd done. And nowadays, I think a lot of the jobs, especially in the, not the consultant tier, but the postgraduate medical tier, have gone over to this very formalised referencing system, which is again very generic, which I think almost detracts from that. I see as trainees or senior trainees competing for fellowships or consultant jobs, we now seem to be in a stage where there's a formalised reference system. It's recognised that non-technical skills are what we need, but the only way to prove that you've got non-technical skills is to go on non-technical skills courses where you have to then achieve and produce your certificate.
It's gone full circle. Yeah.
But that's not the fault. That's not the fault of the people that are in that selection process. That's the fault of the people that are doing the selecting, because they think, what can we measure? What can we formally measure, and how do we measure it? We're obsessed with measuring things.
Right.
And actually, what I was trying to suggest to people is that sometimes, because you can measure it, doesn't mean to say that it's right. And actually, that there are other ways of looking at endpoints and saying, well, this is what we want to achieve. An example I might give might be, the current intensive care medicine new round of appointments where we're looking for run-through training. We're looking for skill sets where people have got a degree of self-awareness, where they can identify issues about themselves that will sort of hopefully be a marker for a future good intensive care consultant. We've not got so far as to formally measuring those soft skills and putting them in as marking criteria, but we can conceive that if you run this through long enough, you might end up with a situation where you have enough data to be able to say, well, this really is important, and we do need to put this in. It is oxymoronic. You keep going round and round and round in circles. Because you can measure it, you must measure it. Therefore, because you can measure it, how do you go back and assess it? And you go round and round and round. But I guess what I was trying to suggest today is that sometimes just because you can measure it doesn't mean to say that that's the major criterion.
Yeah, it's a bit Schrodinger's cat in many ways. As soon as you've identified something that you can measure, you influence
absolutely.
The result.
Absolutely. If you observe it, you change it. Yeah. It's totally Schrodinger's cat. You're dead right.
Thank you very much.
She had a really good quote. Her quote was, "We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit."
I like that. I thought that was really good.
And that quote's by Aristotle.
He's pretty famous.
Yeah.
Almost as famous as Dr. Danielle Bryden.
Yes, of course. We did that whole thing without mentioning.
We did mention the Bake Off, but I think she's a bit sick of that.
I'd be controversial. Which is, I didn't really understand her point. She's a really, really accomplished individual who's done an incredible amount of stuff and is enormously successful. And she doesn't need to compete with anybody else because she is so successful and so accomplished. So for those of us who are not so successful and accomplished, surely there is still a need to compete if we want the end result, which is jobs.
I think her point was, to be happy within your career, you should be less competitive and give yourself challenges that are going to give you rewards. I don't think it's necessary you should stop competing, you'll be successful anyway. So her idea was, or certainly the way I saw it, was that by doing those things that you think will give you pleasure and you'll find rewarding and it will benefit your patients, you will end up having a satisfying career. But she didn't sort of suggest from day one, from the day you leave medical school, you give up. Or indeed, at the person sitting next to you. I think her idea
That's how I took it. And I think that's sort of, that's a general, it's a bit of a life theme. I mean, that's kind of quite, that feels very lovely in how you should live your life, is be yourself, but be better, be the best that you can be at what you do. And I think it almost comes back a little bit to the whole research malarkey again, with you should do what you want to do, what you think will benefit your patients and your practice, that you can do well, rather than trying to aspire to someone else's standards and trying to kind of run along with the rat race like everybody else does. And I think there's actually increasing, to me, in my mind, this is just a part of a massive problem that we've got from truncating training and everything being so streamlined, and that there's people having very generic CVs now. So although we do need everyone to have the equivalent standard of skills to be able to do the same job nationwide, or worldwide ideally, what it does mean is that when it comes to things like applying for jobs in a competitive market, you all have very standard CVs, and so the pressure is always there to try and make yourself stand out more. By standing out more, you go to conferences like this and like many others, and they go, well, the extra things you can do is you can do research and you can do leadership and you can do management, and these are the things that you must do to make yourself stand out, to show that you've gone the extra mile.
But does that make you a good doctor?
Well, exactly.
Does it even actually make you stand out? Because now they quickly become the baseline. And that's the theme that came up in several of the talks I looked at over the last few days that talked about CVs and careers, and quite consistently people said they were looking for things that made people stand out that weren't even necessarily medical, that were far more abstract. And the fact that in whatever your interests are, you can take on a project and see it through to completion, I think is reassuring to me that people giving out jobs and doing shortlisting and looking at those things are not just everybody having the same list of courses and the same list of so-called achievements.
Quite a few people made that point about doing something very specialised, playing an instrument or starting a project, non-medical project. And you're right, the key thing is taking it to completion.
Right.
And in the medical context, an audit, you know, doing the audit to tick the box or actually changing something and re-auditing. It sounds a bit, unfortunate to use a medical example, but it's another good example of project management where you actually finish a project. You're actually motivated by it, you're not just doing it to see.
But
yeah.
I think we're deviating from the message that...
Well, I agree, I think we are deviating from the message, because these are all themes that were brought up, but not during the Pinkerton lecture.
The message I understood from it was that if you see everybody else around you as a competitor, you are then all out for yourselves.
Mm.
And if you're only out for yourself, you break down communication. If you are seeing only yourself as a competitor and improving yourself, and everybody's improving themselves and not against each other, you then have better communication, mm-hmm. You break down those barriers of secrecy, and it's about breaking down the barriers of the traditional hierarchy so that we're not afraid to just talk to our seniors, point out when errors occur. The student nurse can then say to the consultant, sorry, but I think you did that wrong.
Mm.
And this is all about improving patient safety.
You're right. And she also gave a very vivid example of a dysfunctional unit full of very able people who are intensely competitive. So they all do their job incredibly well because they're always trying to outdo the other person. That unit fails. Whereas a unit which you never hear about, where people quietly get on with their job, do it in a collegiate environment where they help each other, but also not that bothered about being the top dog. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, they're the ones who end up with the outcomes. I think that was point that she made. She gave that example of the dysfunctional. She gave a surgical example, which is a bit of a shame. But it's just, but you refer to surgeons as the bad guys, but it's the same in anaesthetic departments.
Yeah.
Competitive, you know, driven departments will often shoot themselves in the foot by being that way.
But again, this might be me being just too binary about everything. It was all a very nice kind of utopian view of how we should do stuff. And I agree, you know, the department that runs very well together, and they could actually prove that they were good by showing patient outcomes. But these are not measurable characteristics, and we're here at GAP, we kind of want practical advice. And I do accept that there is definitely practical advice within what she said about if you want to lead a happy and fulfilled life, do what makes you happy and then be good at what makes you happy. But that's not good advice for people who are trying to get consultant jobs.
Maybe it's good advice for people when they've got consultant jobs.
I'm with Rick. It's quite easy for somebody in that position to say, but would I rather be at a conference and recording an academic podcast or at home with my two-year-old? If I go with the latter, it's all very utopian, as the word Rick used, but ultimately I still have to compete. I have to compete.
But it does add a nice balance, doesn't it, to the conference, to have that kind of message in there as well. It is useful. You know, we're a community. We're not just individuals, exactly as June said.
Don't get me wrong. I think the competition is out of control, and the lengths people go to outdo each other's CVs are out of control. And to some extent, that's because of the standardised nature of recruitment and the point-based shortlisting and all of that. I do appreciate the sentiments, but I think it's not quite real life for us at our stage.
Can I say, as an example of that, would you not rather be here recording a podcast and do something you actually enjoy, rather than doing an audit in something that you have no interest in?
Absolutely, that's the balance I've struck. This is what I do instead. But it's not absolute. I can't absolutely say I will do what I want and it will be all right in the end.
But you are.
But no one's going to do that, because I imagine there'd be lots of people with ridiculous haircuts and playing guitar that everyone just did what they wanted to do. But you have to, if you've picked a career and you run with it, what?
No judgment there at all.
I'm just saying, you know, if you
went... I actually compromise. I have a sensible haircut and play Guitar Hero.
I like it. Can I just say about the, you have to compete. Okay, you have to compete to get the job, or perhaps you could call it you have to stand out to get the job. But when you are in the job, you don't need to compete with other people. You don't have to. That shouldn't be your motivator. I need to be better than them. Your motivator should be I want to be as best as I can be.
That's what I mean. That's the dissonance between. There's two separate messages, I think, and the one, the stuff that we've talked about what I would call CRM. The healthiness of a team and the breaking down of a hierarchy within a team. That's an excellent message, and it's something we've talked about a lot before in our podcast. But I do think we can't avoid a competitive nature to this game. We all want the jobs that we want.
Especially
we
at
have
our
to,
stage.
And we have to compete.
I'm also quite better at people, and she's become successful and got the role she has with a master's and a law degree and various other things, including intensive care postgraduate qualifications. And she went on a competitive program to bake and did really well on it. So
I think the key message is about sustainability, though. She's trying to say if you get your motivations on something that's going to sustain you, then that benefits you, it benefits patients, it benefits the department. And I think actually it's about that. It's about the longevity of our careers.
And you're right, Chris. She did mention that sustainability. That was her sort of...
But I think you guys have actually, you've won me around a bit more now. And there were definitely some excellent points for leading a happy and fulfilled career, which, to be honest, is where most of us are going to spend our lives, is not in the rat race of trying to get a consultant job or a sub-consultant job or whatever it is we end up doing. It's in doing that afterwards. And there were loads of really great points, and she did speak absolutely beautifully. Mark, I should think this probably rolls on quite nicely to the mentoring session you went on to.
It does, yeah. And unlike the rest of you, I'm not talking about a specific lecture we've seen this week, but one of the additional services that the GAP provided, which was individual mentoring sessions. And this is something we talked about last year, and Nancy Redfern from Newcastle was talking about the growth of mentoring in anaesthesia and all across medicine. And they've gone a step further this year and provided introductory sessions. So I was quite interested for several reasons, mainly because it's currently a hot topic. It's being pushed out in lots of different specialties, not just anaesthesia. And I've definitely, as a trainee moving around, identified inadequacies whereby some places have really good educational supervision and somebody who, without being officially titled as a mentor, would behave as such, right through to the other end of the spectrum, where I would feel lost and alone in a new hospital and not quite sure of what I was doing with my career. I have to admit I'm quite sceptical that
And this is why it follows on from our last discussion. I'm sceptical that mentoring is so trendy at the moment that if everybody decides to be a mentor, we could end up with loads of people who want to be a mentor more for their own CV progression than for any more altruistic motivations.
And perhaps competencies in mentoring.
Right, exactly. Like all sorts of courses and qualifications and teaching skills, and I worry that it becomes the next tick box. I'm sure you've all met people around the circuit who are an educational supervisor, but you suspect they have very little actual interest in your welfare and more interest in having that on their CV and the extra session a week to do whatever it is that they do. And so, after listening to Nancy Redfern talk again on Wednesday, despite her lecture being worryingly titled "How Mentoring Can Enhance My CV," she is clearly very enthusiastic. She's done a lot of good work on this and won over a lot of people. And so she did manage to motivate me to keep an open mind and book myself in for a taster session. It's quite impressive that at a large conference like this, they can manage to administer full hour-long sessions for pretty much anybody who wanted one. So it was a fairly easy process. I didn't know what to expect from the session. And as the time grew closer, I did get less and less enthusiastic about it. However, I was pleasantly surprised. So my mentor, as it turned out, was not an anaesthetist, but was a senior doctor with experience in education and deanery college type stuff. The fact that he wasn't an anaesthetist actually turned out to be way less of an issue than I would have expected. We started talking briefly about what mentoring isn't. It's not giving advice, it's not counselling, it's not therapy. Their goal really is to help me recognise where I am and where I want to get to, and most importantly, what I have to do to get there. He explained the training they do. There are, as you can imagine, lots of training courses springing up at the moment, and lots of books and frameworks that they use to structure the interview. But I have to say, I was never conscious of him using a framework or a technique on me. It seemed like a normally flowing conversation. He put me at ease very quickly, and yeah, we talked about all sorts of career plans. He looked at my CV, we talked through that. We talked about personality traits and how I might look at assessing and correcting some of my personality faults, deficiencies, weaknesses, whatever you want to call them. But we got into even more personal stuff. We talked about work-life balance and time management and managing an ambitious career with a young family. And interestingly, he did once or twice give fairly specific advice or instructions, but much more of it was making me answer my own questions with the answers that I already knew but was probably reluctant to face up to on my own. So, in summary, I found the whole thing to be genuinely helpful, and even though it was just a 1 hour session, I do have a list of action points that I'm going to try to achieve over the next few weeks. I still do have some reservations about the whole concept of mentoring. I think I got lucky and had a very nice guy. I think this might be quite personality dependent. I'm not sure if all of it is something that can be taught or whether, you know, some people are just nice guys. I still worry that it could easily become the next in the long line of CV boxes that everybody wants to tick, meaning we have hundreds of trainees going on expensive courses while only a few of them actually really care about being a valuable mentor. I know, Sibs, that you also did a session, and I think your experiences were a little different to mine.
So my experiences were entirely different, with equally good outcomes. I had a young anaesthetic trainee who'd obviously been trained in mentoring. We spent quite a bit of the session talking about the principles behind it, and he did explain that it's structured. The basis of it is to try and encourage you to give all the answers. And he actually went through some of the methodology behind it with me, mainly because I probed him for it to try and get a feel why he was doing it. He was very good. He's obviously done this before, and he was able to sort of take me through stages of the scenario that I gave him, and we did come up with action plan. You know, and he was very good at what he does, but I think there's an element of the senior person who's got experience directing you through something with confidence, is you're more likely to respond to that and perhaps open up a little bit more. So I went through quite a lot with him and came up with ideas that will make a difference, but I don't think I would, if he were to suggest something to me, I always perhaps to my own fault, would always second guess that or try and think that perhaps his experience means that he doesn't really, you know, he's not doing justice to the initial question.
I understand what you meant, but wasn't half the point of it, which as I got from Mark, was the fact that he's not meant to suggest things, that he's kind of like a sounding board, and in fact you come up with it.
So, but the reason that I mentioned that is I was talking about specific subspecialty and aesthetic concerns, and I think if someone hasn't experienced those subspecialties, then it's quite hard to comment and to make not only necessarily make suggestions, but ask the right questions. Mm-hmm. So if you're talking about specific hospitals or specific setups or specific issues within departments, then Mark's guy, who's quite senior and within the medical hierarchy, but also in terms of education and deanery roles, and he can give advice about which way careers can go and can mentor you in different ways than someone who's quite early on in that process.
The thing is that the chap I talked to wasn't an anaesthetist, and the main part of our discussion also focused on my career path and the fact that I'm essentially going for a subspecialty that doesn't really exist, and it's quite an atypical path I'm trying to forge. And I just thought, I almost dismissed him straight away, thinking, well, how can he answer this? But he drew out of me the answers that I already knew, which is, you know, who do you need to talk to? And I think maybe it's the right combination of his personality type and mine. I'm quite bad for keeping my head in the sand. I know I need to go and have the scary conversation with the chief of the department in the hospital I'd like to work to and lay it all out there. And I can quite happily ignore that for months. So to me, this mentoring might almost be like a Weight Watchers Club. As I understand it, a Weight Watchers Club will mainly work
through your experience.
Through you have to go there and be weighed in front of everybody. And you're being motivated by peer pressure. So if I've met this guy and made an action plan that I'm going to do these things next month, and I've got to go back and see him a month later, that might just give me the push to do the things. Whereas being in charge of myself, I will defer and
procrastinate
and come up with excuses and hope that I bumble through. So,
but how is that different from counselling, by the way? If for somebody to come to you to not be able to give you targeted advice, but to get you to talk about your situation and have you produce your own answers, I thought that's what counselling is
about. Well, counselling is kind of always or generally associated with having a problem, hence why you go to a counsellor.
Well,
whereas this is, I don't have a problem, I just need to, in actual fact,
you
do have a problem.
I've got loads of problems.
And they ask
but mentoring
and
is about trying to move forward
But I think also the thing that surprised me most, that he made the point, that is the fact that he's an anaesthetist was actually an anomaly, and the fact that your guy's a doctor is actually not that important. The way purists mentor is you are of another profession or another specialty or of no specialty. You're a life coach, as it were. And you take people through scenarios based on the principles and framework of mentoring rather than specialist knowledge you have. Or indeed, going against what I've just said, your own experience is almost irrelevant as well. So in some sense, somebody who's completely detached is probably the best mentor if they're adequately trained.
You hit the nail on the head, actually, because initially I was quite cynical, and my argument was always, what can you say to a mentor that you can say to your best friend? And some people say, well, maybe it's easier to talk to a stranger and open up to a stranger, but these strangers are people you may be working with in future. It's the skills that they have learned to guide you through.
And my guy was able
answers.
To do that. He was exceptionally good at this. He's obviously learned the skills as well. And it's my problem that I went to thinking, because he's a junior anaesthetist, he won't be able to necessarily come up with suggestions.
It's not just about, with your best friend, it's not just about you telling them stuff, it's about them telling you stuff. Because your best friend might not necessarily tell you the things you need to hear. It sounds like this person does tell you the things you need to hear.
Yeah, he did say he will. It'll get rough at times. They will challenge you. You know, you've just told me that you to achieve that goal you need to speak to that person. Why haven't you done it yet?
Best friends always do that.
They
absolutely do not.
Best friends will often tell you
what
you want.
I don't know who your friends
with. I didn't find it useful.
Did you go as well?
No, I've done one before. I really didn't find it. So I would have liked to have spent that time in a room by myself, blank piece of paper, and I could have worked all those problems out myself. And I'd argue that actually all that mentoring
could have. This
is
the thing for me. This is why I say it may work for me. I could have worked all those things out, but never quite got round to it.
But you wouldn't action
it.
Maybe
you go again. What do you need to go again?
you know, now it's allowed you to realise that, you know, you've got everything within you to push your goals forward. All you need to do is ask yourself those questions.
I would like to, I would have liked to have started this 5 years ago, and to have had a consistent contact throughout the moving around and the changes that my career and life have had.
So a mentor in the department, within the specialty, or the college.
Like you said, beyond that, someone outside all of that probably, and someone who was consistent throughout all of the other changes.
Well, thanks very much for that, Mark. It's really interesting to hear you speak about that, because knowing you as I do, I think the most compelling bit of that entire thing is the fact that you really got something out of it, and it's something that not only would you consider doing again, but something that you wish you'd done before. So it sounds great.
And recommend to others, perhaps.
And recommend to others. So I will definitely keep my eye out for anything related to mentoring.
Will you go and get yourself a mentor?
I don't know. I kind of agree with Mark that maybe... Well, it's probably not too late, is it? That's probably a silly
opinion. No, I don't
think so. That's going to be the big test of time. Will I seek out... You know,
was that one of his action points? You should seek out...
Well, no, we never discussed further appointments, but there is... literature from the AAGBI with a kind of lead person for almost all of the deaneries now have a lead, and if not, if anybody wants to get more information, Nancy Redfern from Newcastle, who you'll be able to find through the AAGBI, would be a good place to start. It wasn't discussed, and again, probably my general pacificity, is that a word?
Pacificity.
Let's go with
now.
It is now. I think it works. We understand what it means.
I think you've owned that.
Means I might not, but certainly I've got some leads to follow.
So thanks very much for that. We'll definitely link to some of Nancy Redfern's stuff and about how you can find out more about mentoring and what the AAGBI has to offer. All right, so going from Mark's mentoring, actually, to an interview you did, Sibs, with Sir John Michael, who is... Chief Executive, well, he's an unusual physician Chief Executive of Oxford NHS Trust, but has been previously Chief Executive of another two NHS Trusts.
That's right, he's one of the very few medical Chief Executives, and he's previously took Guardian St Thomas's through Foundation Trust status, and has worked in Birmingham as well.
So let's hear what he had to say to you about what he looks for in potential consultants.
The GATT annual scientific meeting with Sir Jonathan Michael, the Chief Executive of Oxford University's NHS Foundation Trust. So if I may start by asking Sir Jonathan, is there anything in particular you think you look for in the consultants of the future that perhaps wasn't as pertinent, say, 5 or 10 years ago?
No, I think the requirements are the same. Perhaps the way they're expressed is different. I mean, first and foremost, I'm looking for technical competence. I need somebody who can do the job. You know, that we have advertised or they're applying for. So clinical technical competence is first and foremost. Secondly, it is a question of having the right set of values and attitude. You know, we are a caring business. We are looking after vulnerable patients, and therefore the whole attitude of staff is important. So competence, attitude and values, and then I'm looking for ambition. I want somebody who is hungry to succeed, to help us to develop the services that they're part of. And because I'm running a university hospital, I'm also looking for people who are academic in the sense that they have the right approach to clinical practice. I don't mean academic in the sense of being employed by a university. I mean approaching their clinical practice in an academic way, critically analysing their activity, keeping themselves up to date, and so on and so forth, participating in clinical research. So apart from that, the ability to walk on water would be quite useful, but that's an optional extra.
Do you think there's anything in particular about the current financial landscape that we find ourselves in that affects the sort of people you look for or the characteristics of those individuals?
I think there is an increasing requirement for people to understand the context within which we're all working. So one of my concerns is people coming to apply for consultant posts don't have a lot of opportunity of managerial training. There's often there's a sort of a statutory week of management training somewhere. Sure. So I think a greater understanding of the environment within which we're working, and clearly the economic environment is one of those, but it's only one of those. I mean, there's the whole issue of quality environment, the changing expectations of society and of patients. You know, people do need to understand where we as clinicians and healthcare practitioners, where we're working.
And finally, do you envisage a future where perhaps people applying for consultant jobs, especially subspecialties, would have to put forward a business plan to not only apply for the job, to justify that role in itself?
No, I think that will have been done before people have applied. So what is required is when an organisation wishes to develop a new service or appoint to a new consultant, then they will go through a business planning process. Once the decision to make an appointment has been made, then the individuals are appointed. So I don't see that as something that applicants will have to do, because it'll be done before. But they need to understand what the business case effectively says, because they'll need to understand what is expected of them, what the department that they're joining is planning and developing. So I see that as an organisational responsibility, not as an individual responsibility.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
That's a pleasure.
Brilliant.
So some great advice there. That leads on quite nicely to a classic debate, pro-con debate. This House believes that the sub-consultant grade is a good idea, which he actually changed to this House believes a consultant-led service is both feasible and desirable. The delivery was absolutely phenomenal. It was William Harrod Griffiths playing both sides of the debate. In fact, changing characters and changing presentation styles.
It and was, changing clothes.
And changing clothes.
And names.
It was,
and names.
It was a masterpiece of presentation. It was truly excellent. I think, actually, it's probably worth just spending 5 minutes just seeing what everyone else thought. We'll just do a quick survey around the table. He was basically saying the sub-consultant grade, whatever you call it, is potentially an inevitability that we all might face at some point, and were we for and against. So just quickly, around the table, he took a poll at the beginning and he took a poll at the end. What were you for or against? Myself, I will say I thought that a consultant service is both feasible and desirable before and after. It didn't change my opinion, but I thought the arguments were good. Priya?
Exactly the same, actually, yeah. Yes, before and after.
Perfect.
G? The same, before and after.
What, that it's both desirable?
It's both desirable and feasible.
Likewise, I also said that both, yes, before and after. It was difficult to summarise, certainly difficult to summarise in 5 minutes, and I think he did a reasonable job. But it all depends on how you define some consulting.
Yeah, on that point, I did change my vote, but only because he went away a bit from the actual semantics of the name of the grade and pointed out that whether we like it or not, the foundation trusts are likely to create some sort of grade that provides a lot of the work without the full terms and conditions of being a consultant, and it may be better to embrace that and accept some degree of, you know, working more antisocial hours as a junior consultant, sub-consultant, senior registrar, whatever you're going to call it. It might be better if it comes from us rather than is imposed on us.
I think that's why he managed to swing the vote, because he put the fear factor out there that if you do not engage with this process, it's going to happen anyway. So people felt they may as well.
Chai?
I changed my vote. I started off by saying yes. I think I found it slightly blurred in that the issues with it partly are, if you have it completely consultant-led, yes, it's desirable and feasible in that, yes, there's a lot of consultants around, and they could be around enough to provide more anaesthesia, which would be desirable, as he said. You would want your family and friends or anybody else to have the highest level of skill in delivering an anaesthetic. But if the consultants are going to do all the anaesthetising, how are the trainees going to get the experience to learn to then be in that position? Secondly, we started this thing off talking about how much consultants get paid. And frankly, for the bulk of the work that they do and the sheer numbers there are, surely it is too much. Surely the only way to have a sustainable NHS is for everybody to just be a bit more sensible, take a bit of a pay cut, step back a little bit, let's all just spread it out a bit more. Go back to maybe having people who, you do need to have trainees and consultants for exactly those reasons. You need someone to ensure optimal care, and you need trainees to be able to have the exposure and not de-skill like they have been over the last 10, 20 years.
And I agree with you, because the biggest fear of bringing in a sub-consultant grade is that we would A, get paid less, and B, not have career progression. We may be stuck in a non-career grade kind of role. And I'm sure all of us would agree to being paid less. After all, we are in a caring, slightly altruistic profession. But
gets paid more than generals and the Prime Minister.
Yeah,
that's right. High Court judges, but have we not judges? Earned it? But the second argument is that it's all about name. What's in a name?
That was one of the big things. There are three themes that came out. One, feasibility. Can we get, you know, is there money to deliver this service? And do we need to take a pay cut? Or do we need to change the way the pay structure is done for consultants of different specialties, which I thought was really interesting.
The suggestion was you should pay people more for doing nights. The idea that the pay scale would actually go up, which of course is a bit strange, but...
It's nonsense.
Well, I don't think that's nonsense.
Not if you take away from people who aren't doing nights.
Yeah, right. Exactly. A disparity. Yeah, it is. I think that's reasonable to say...
But the point was made, the on-call component is only 5% of a person's salary.
But restructuring rather than for you to be paid more, which makes sense.
Okay, so... Danger money. Conversation for working
nights. I'm interested... Sid, you and I half started a conversation during that thing. So one of the points that William Harrod Griffiths made when he was proposing that, yes, it is both desirable and feasible, was that the reason it's feasible is there is not enough money for the way we currently pay consultants. If you want a consultant-led anaesthesia service, this is going to mean resident on-calls, people coming in at night because it's not predictable. And that costs more money. They're physically there more. So we should change the way we pay consultants of all specialties, and you should be paid for the work you actually do, which would mean taking money away from what he termed daytimeologists, such as dermatology or neurology or anything that's kind of outpatient-based, and put it to those specialties that do have to be resident on call. So that struck me as, that seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to do. And obviously, we're a group of six anaesthetists who are sitting around discussing it. We haven't got anybody to defend in the corner. But I said to you, Sips, when I was saying, that seems very reasonable. And you said, no, you could never, ever do that. Why?
Well, I don't think it's affordable. So what you're talking about is the North American model or the Australian model or certain Northern European countries where consultants are paid twice or 2.5 times as much as they are here, and therefore they come in during the night and they work at the weekends. In North America, you can't bill for a case unless you're present. So the registrar does not anaesthetise an appendectomy in the middle of the night because the consultant relies on it for his bread and butter, so he'll come in. In Australia, consultant anaesthetists are paid $250,000 to $300,000 a year, and they are more involved in out-of-hours care. Likewise, in Northern Europe, in Belgium and Holland, emergency cover for anaesthesia and surgery provided by fully trained specialists. But we do not, that's not something that's financially viable in this country.
Well, it's not financially viable because of the NHS and our structure of healthcare, unless you take that money away from somewhere. So it's got to come from somewhere else. So his point was, why can't we take it away from those people who aren't working the same hours? In our medical ranking system, they're the same grade, but they're doing a completely different work pattern.
The lobby power of the Royal College of Physicians is far greater and outpunches the acute specialties. So the audiologists he speaks of have a different power base. They are historically influential, and there is no way that the acute specialties can persuade or dissuade those people from being on call and therefore taking the payments for.
It's not a question of logic, it's completely logical. It's just there's a historical thing there that can't be done for political reasons.
Interestingly, he gave an example of a report that had come out from the Federation of the Colleges of Physicians of the United Kingdom, so both the English, Scottish, and Irish colleges, and they independently decreed that their trainees, certainly their registrars, at the beginning of their jobs, were not necessarily to be pressured into performing procedures such as pacing, but in particular, pertinent to this conversation, to be persuaded to carry out central venous access on call. So the medical registrar in the olden days would have put a central line in under duress, is now no longer necessarily pressured into doing that, and they've independently, unilaterally delegated that role to other specialties, namely anaesthesia, actually named
anaesthesia.
Intensive care. Now that's an example where they feel, because of their position within the medical hierarchy or medical structure, that they can make those decisions in it. So if you take that one step further, you can't imagine a situation where those colleges will agree to the non-ologist, if you will, the anaesthetist or the intensivist or any other specialty, taking their slice of the cake and taking them off on call. I can't imagine the respiratory physician or the neurologist or the rheumatologist giving up his pay or dropping his pay to allow us to do on-call.
But could you not make that argument to the taxpayers? Because they're the one they're the people who pay our salaries. Could you not say to them, right, you want consultant-led service, and say, right, the only way we can have a consultant-led service is if we pay consultants for the time that they put in. And take away this fact that these medical colleges are so powerful and say, this is what the public want. The only way to deliver this service is to pay consultants for the time they are physically doing the work, and then take it from there.
The argument will be that they are physically doing the work. So there's an argument about presence. The words already changed from consultant-delivered care to consultant-present care. And they will come up with an argument, and perhaps fairly, if you look at it from their point of view, as you say, they're not here to defend their corner, that they are involved in that care. They don't have to have their hands dirty and be wearing scrubs and have gloves on. They are nevertheless providing that care.
I think the other thing is, no matter how much political, how much sort of historical backness is, we are at a time at sort of crisis point where if we don't, everybody's talking about radical change, the government's on it, the colleges are all on it, we've got to move things along if we're actually going to have sustainable NHS. And it's not enough to say, it's never been done, we're not going to be able to do it, we can't actually go down that route. It's not just take it away from the other specialties, it's going to be within our own specialties, maybe cut back on these very, very high earners, which is not necessarily... I'm not going to say that the 146, so nobody should get that. But it's going to be one of these things where you've just got to restructure all of it.
I want to make a very good point, which is half of NHS trusts are now foundation trusts. So if foundation trusts are able to do what they want and create sub-consultant regardless, then half the trusts are empowered to do that, and that's only going to increase.
Sub-consultant grade, I have a little acronym for it. It's more like subhuman in training still.
I tell you what,
let's call it a junior consultant. I would accept.
I don't like junior consultant. I hate that more.
There was a lot of stuff, and it's clearly there seems to be a lot of offence caused by the name.
It doesn't matter what they call it. It's what the name represents, and the name to me represents a certain salary. I'm sick of us being shamed into being embarrassed about our salary. The media do this a lot. It's above average. Fine. It's not an average job. So I expect a salary and I expect some security, i.e. current consultants have that job for a long period of time and can at last stop moving around and buy a house and have children, things that we often put off to later than average. And so whether they call that a senior reg or a junior consultant or a sub-consultant, I would take that. I can accept working nights and working odd hours and having a different job plan to the senior consultants, as long as I can get those things and some kind of assurance that there is progression and that it's not just going to be like that forever.
So in the interest of time, we'll move on because we've been going on about the stuff that we've all found really interesting, which has been some of the management and some of the more ethical debates. But in fact, there's loads of really good clinical stuff at GATT, which we've kind of been skipping over a little bit. So.
But that was the beauty of GATT. I think it provided for all levels and all rankings of trainees. So we're approaching consultant jobs, so we're interested in the management, but you know, it also provided for people going through exams or starting out in anaesthesia, and it covered all areas.
There were multiple streams throughout for exams and for junior and senior trainees.
And that concludes the first part of our advert for 2014 Newcastle. So before we finish off, Chaya, you haven't had a chance to tell us about what it was that you found really exciting at this year's conference.
Oh, I don't know if exciting... No, okay, exciting. We'll go with that. You're going to love me because I'm also keeping it clinical. The one of the case presentations for the Orr Prize was by Dr. Spooner, who had a talk entitled "A Broken Heart in Day Case, Do Anaesthetists Know Enough?" And he mentioned something that I've not heard about before, which is called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. It's also apparently known as broken heart syndrome and stress-induced cardiomyopathy. And Takotsubo is based... got its name from the shape of the heart with reference to the shape of some sort of fishing bowl in Japan.
It's an octopus catching pot.
It's a device.
That's the one. In Japan, quite right. So the main bits about this, basically, it was a case presentation, a little bit about the broken heart syndrome itself, but completely reversible, a stress-induced cardiomyopathy, and it's apparently due to stress, so either emotional or physiological, and a significant adrenaline release leads to coronary artery spasm and cardiac stunning, and there's reversible cardiac dysfunction, which can last several days. And although it's very rare, and there's lots of awfully terribly rare things. I think the thing about his was it may not necessarily be that rare. It's only really been described in the last 6 or 7 years, but there seems to be a massive spate of case presentations of late, apparently, not that I've seen them. And it's associated with things like anxiety and stress, and it may well be just that it's very underdiagnosed. So when there are those strange events that happen intraoperatively in a patient that you wouldn't have expected anything, and they seem to miraculously reverse, could this be that? Could it be Takotsubo? Subo that? So
Octopus pot syndrome.
Octopus pot syndrome. Let's not call it that because that's more confusing.
I quite like the heartbreak syndrome.
Yeah, it was very good. Broken heart syndrome. And yeah, so I think it was just, again, another thing of, like they say with everything else, bear it in mind, could it be this? Keep your eyes open. Reversible.
What was really great about that case was that it's Takotsubo has been described in people who have undergone some kind of emotional stress, and there's been the link with catecholamine release. But this is actually a patient who I think had learning difficulties.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was in the perioperative period when they thought that the actual induction of anesthesia was stressful. And I'm sure we've all been in situations where we've had an induction of anesthesia where there's been a strange event and we've not really been able to explain it. We've done some kind of fudge explanation and then things have got better over time. Well, but this is one of those things to think about. And I just thought it was, they obviously caught it
on
ECG and echo.
Well, they caught it on it. The main thing about this, I mean, the patient went on to arrest and then was treated with adrenaline. And so one of the questions is, you've got a coronary event brought on by a surge of adrenaline and then we're treating it with adrenaline. This seems very strange. And so the pathophysiology is not fully understood. And as you say, there's lots of kind of fudging around it because we just don't know enough about it. And it just brings another thing to, should we be avoiding that degree of anxiety and stress by pre-medicating and maybe doing it a little bit more liberally than I think the sort of there's been a trend towards.
In patients with learning disabilities?
Well, in patients who are massively distressed, because actually it's not like this has only ever come back or in learning difficulty children or in anybody else. I don't know what the other cases, how they've presented.
But the point I found interesting about that case was the increased incidence after a national disaster, for example, they found after the New Zealand earthquakes. Mm. There was a sudden incidence in what originally they thought was MIs because of the shock of the earthquake, but now seems to be cardiomyopathy, stress-induced.
I couldn't work out the pathophysiology of that.
Well, that's what he said as well. Who knows? It's clearly something that we've not fully managed to figure out. Research demands research. That's
according to
Wikipedia. Is it not even on Wikipedia?
It is. It is on Wikipedia, and according to Wikipedia, it is unknown.
Oh. There we go, it's official. I'm going to have to wait for it to be on QI, and then we will know.
When Stephen Fry tells us, then it becomes fact.
That's
awesome, right. So, moving from Stephen Fry and QI to our own game, it's time to end the podcast, but we couldn't do that without playing Biology or Bunkum. So, I am quite pleased with this one. It's, I think, over the last couple of episodes, it's been maybe a little bit too easy. Mark's been winning a little bit too frequently. So we are in the city of Dreaming Spires, which is Oxford. So I had to do an Oxford-based Biology or Bunkum, and this one is called Knights and Nobel Prizes. So all four of the people I'm about to tell you about have got a link to Oxford University and have won a Nobel Prize, but you have to say where you think the falsehood lies in what I'm about to tell you. Person of interest number one, Sir John Eccles, 1903 to 1997. Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine, which is going to be a theme because they all won that, for his work on synapses using peripheral nerve reflex arcs. Number two, Sir Howard Florey, Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for his role in the discovery of penicillin. And unlike Alexander Fleming, who we all know discovered the fact that penicillin had antibacterial properties, he was one of the two people who actually went along and made it quite useful. Number three, Sir Lee Teabing, Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine. Sir Lee is a developmental biologist best known for his work on cloning. His prize was for working out how to convert mature cells into stem cells. And number four, Sir Peter Medawar, who won his Nobel Prize for his work on graft rejection and the discovery of acquired immune tolerance and his work that made organ transplantation a real possibility.
That's a very difficult.
Unless you tell us what year, because then we can perhaps say.
Okay, well, no, let's see how we. Oh, so I'll tell you the year. So John Eccles was 1903 to 1997. Sir Howard Florey, 1898 to 1968, Sir Lee Teabing, 1933 to present, or Sir Peter Medawar, 1915 to 1987.
Is that their lifespans?
Yes, that is their lifespans. So they're all 20th century Nobel Prizes.
Okay, I'll go first. I think Sir John Eccles.
Sir John Eccles. You didn't like Sir John Eccles.
I didn't like Sir John Eccles because that name sounds familiar, and I think the year that you gave is wrong, and his role is wrong too.
So you don't like Sir John Eccles. So there's something about the name you don't like for Sir John Eccles.
He is involved in medicine, but I don't think he won a Nobel Prize, and I don't think he was born or lived within that period.
Okay. All right, interesting. So June's John Eccles. Sibs.
Can I hear the last one?
So the last one was Sir Peter Medawar, who was a British biologist whose work on graft rejection and discovery of acquired immune tolerance made organ transplantation possible.
Okay, I'm going out on a limb. I think that's the bunkum.
So what about it?
That name doesn't ring any bells, and I've spent lots of time reading about this, about organ transplantation, but that might just mean I haven't read about him.
Okay, fair enough.
What was the third one?
So the third one was Sir Lee Teabing, who was a developmental, still is a developmental biologist, known for his work on cloning, and his prize was for working out how to convert mature cells back into stem cells.
I think it's that one, because I think that's only been done quite recently. So
yeah, he's still alive. 1933 is present. You can go with it.
Yeah.
It could have happened last week.
You'll go with it. Okay. Go with your gut. All right. Okay. Interesting. Shia?
I'm going to say the first one, just because there's no reason. What did you say it was? Was it peripheral reflex arcs?
Work on synapses by peripheral reflex arcs. John Eccles... his prize was for work on synapses, which he used peripheral reflex arcs as his vehicle for demonstrating how synapses worked.
Am I allowed to ask for number two for the penicillin one? What was the name?
Sir Howard Florey.
See, I've not heard of them. Why have I not heard of? I've heard of Fleming. I feel like they should be. Is this bad?
No, so it's a
have you heard of any of them?
There is one. It's a tricky.
No, it's a complex biology.
I have really dialed it up this time because I did feel it was getting a bit easy.
I'm going to go with the peripheral reflex arcs.
You don't like the peripheral reflex?
Maybe they're all made up.
That's not how you would have gone for working out how synapses work. It's interesting.
No, I would do. No, stop it. Only because I think all the others are really tangible. Actually, I think they're all perfectly usable. I don't know. I think I would just, if this was MCQ, I would go true. So
biology and biology.
Yeah, exactly.
Game over.
And Mark, the
I think you're onto something there. I don't think Rick's made up any of these people or what they did. I think what he's done, because it's Oxford, is probably one of them was from Cambridge, and nobody said number two, so I'll say that one.
Okay. Well, all right. Very good. Very good. I'm going to give you bonus points, Mark, for getting the methodology, but sadly the answer right. No, those are all true bits of science. They are true Nobel Prize winners, apart from Sir Lee Teabing, who is in fact a fictional Oxford graduate and from the Da Vinci Code.
Oh!
So I was wondering if anyone could remember
the name.
I've
never seen the Da Vinci Code. That's not fair.
It was in fact Sir John Gurdon who won the Nobel Prize, who was a genuine Oxford graduate who won the Nobel Prize for his work on stem cells.
So it was
Sir John Gurdon, not Sir Lee Teabing.
And that was the second one.
So it was a tricky one. Well, no one wins a prize because I. Unusually for biology or bunkum, won that. But thanks very much for playing. So my prize is that it's time to end the podcast. So thanks very much for listening. It's been a fantastic conference. We're looking forward to going to GAT 2014, which is going to be in Newcastle. And hopefully we'll see you then. And we'll be back next month with our regular schedule. So thanks for listening. Cool.